Our esteemed guest here is in ABS and their relation to the ABS CFT correspondence. Here I listed a partial list of relevant references. So these two are review papers by Vasiliev. He has a lot of review papers. I just picked two of them here. This focus mostly on the ABS 4 case, which is the one I will concentrate on in these lectures. And so these are the papers Klebanov and Polyakov and Setkin and Sandel about some precise conjecture which relates this highest engaged theory in ABS 4 to some vector models in three dimensions. And these are these are my papers with Qiyin, in which we check these conjectures at the level of the three-point functions. And so depending how the lectures go, hopefully toward the end of the lectures I will describe a little bit about these calculations. Okay, so to start, let me just, as an introduction or as a motivation of why we want to study higher spin gauge fields in ABS, let me start from a case of the theory of a free M vector phi I goes from 1 to n. Phi is some complex scalar field. So we just take a free theory with a very simple action. So phi transforms some vector representation of un, let's say, and phi star in the conjugate representation. And of course, this is a CFT, but it's a very trivial one, it's just a free CFT. And so in this theory, we can immediately see that there are a lot of conserved charges. For example, with a familiar spin one current. One current which is conserved because using the equations of motion. But then, like as in any CFT, we also have a spin 2 conserved current, which is just a stress energy tensor. And for this theory, in the dimension, the stress energy tensor can be written in the following form. And these brackets denote symmetrization. Okay, this is the form of the stress tensor for this theory, and as I said, it's a conserved spin two current and it's traceless. Dimension is conformal dimension, it's just mean in dimensions. And okay, this is obvious here. I can say that the conformal dimension in this case is d minus 2 plus 1 equal d minus 1. It will be clear in a moment why I wrote it in this way. Okay, so these are the basic currents that we are very familiar with, but it's easy to see, since this is a free theory, that there is actually an infinite power of higher spin currents which are also conserved. And so schematically, these higher spin currents are the following form. So they are symmetric and traceless tensors with S indices, which roughly have the following forms. So there are S derivatives which are distributed in several different ways among the fields. So this dot 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 is all the remaining terms in which derivatives are put in different ways, and so actually there is an explicit form for this if you are interested in. So all these terms can be written in this way. So this one getting this form by requiring that is a concern which fixes this coefficient. So this is an expression for the current, and one can check using the equations of motions that this current are conserved. Okay. And their conformal dimension is d minus 2 plus s, where s is the spin. Actually, it follows from the conformal algebra that if you have a current, primary current like this, which is conserved, then its dimension is going to be d minus 2 plus s, which agrees with, of course, with what we get here in the free theory by just engineering dimensions. Okay. So, this currents are, as I said, they are primary operators of this free CFT, and actually they are all the primaries which are built out of just two scalars, out of bilinears of the scalars. And so these bilinears of the scalars are basically the analog in these vector models of the single trace operators that we are used to in adjoint theories. So here there is a single contraction of this UN index, and this is analogous of a single trace object in a adjoint field. So all objects which have more than two scalars are analog of multi-trace directories. For example, so multi-linear objects. Can be thought of as multi-trace operators and by analogy with the adjoint case. Okay, so
restricting it into key singles?
Okay, yes, that's a good question. So here, if you look at this theory by itself, there is no reason to restrict the singlets. So in the context of ADS-CFT and in the context of these conjectures, you do require to restrict to singlet sector because basically, well, in the dual theories, as we will see, there is nothing which can carry this Fleber index. So one way to state that is that you could gauge this symmetry and then take the gauge coupling to zero. So the theory becomes free, but you still have the constraint that you should only take engaging by end operators.
Zero or infinity? You don't want to fluctuate in gauge
No, it's just the Gauss constraint.
Zero.
Okay. Okay. So we have a CFT, and we have this spectrum of single trace operators in the theory, which are operators with spins from 1 to infinity. Actually, I should mention that there is also a spin zero operator, which is also contained here, which is just the one without derivative. It's not really a current, but just for convenience, we can include it in this. There is, of course, also the scalar operator. Okay, so we have this spectrum of single trace primaries with spins from zero to infinity. So since this is SCFT, by ADS-CFT, we would expect this to be dual to something in ADS. And by the standard law of ADS-CFT, we know that if we have a CFT in RD with some conserved current, then the conserved current should be dual in ADS to D plus 1 to some gauge field, which carries the same spin representation of the curve. So we see that we expect by looking at this CFT that the ADS tool should be some higher spin gauge field. So these are gauge fields because these currents are conserved. So if you want, this is a CFT. If you believe in a lot, this is a CFT argument to say that we should expect some interactive higher spin gauge theory in ADS to exist. It should be just the ADS dual of this simple theory. Okay. Let me clarify why these gauge fields are interacting in the bulk. So if we imagine the computation of correlation functions in this CFT from the ADS-CFT dictionary, we would compute some kind of a Witten diagram like this, which is the boundary of ADS, and we have our currents, let's say, three-point functions of three currents of spin S1, S2, and S3. So by the standard dictionary, this should be computed by some Witten diagram in which the currents are dual to some propagating higher spin gauge fields, which interact at some point in the bulk. So there is some interaction vertex here among these gauge fields of G bulk. So if we normalize these currents in such a way that the two-point function scales like 1, meaning that basically we just take this current, this bilinear current, and divide them by 1 over square root of n. This is because if we compute a two-point function, let me omit the derivatives. Of bilinear like this, is of course by contracting scales like n. So normalized current will just be the same bilinear ring normalized by the square root of n. So if we consider normalized currents like this, then the three-point function, it's easy to see that it goes like 1 over square root of n, which means that this coupling constant in the bulk theory is proportional to 1 over square root of n. So from the bulk point of view, the n going to infinity limit is the free limit, and the coupling constant is 1 over square root of n. So n in this free theory is the only parameter that we have, so that's the coupling constant of the bulk. If you imagine some kind of gravitational theory written in terms of Newton constant and cosmological constant, this will be the only dimensionless coupling constant which you can build by taking ratio of those two dimensional quantities. Yes?
Can you discuss a bit more what is the more global motivation? Is this, just to understand better radius CFT, or to then go away from this free theory into more useful, or do you expect this part discussion to be useful computation in a tool for this specific theory?
Right, so one motivation is to understand ADS-CFT in opposite limits to each other, which we need to know. But let me go on, and because I'm planning to discuss this already. So, okay, there are many motivations. Along the way, probably I will have a chance to say more about it. okay. so let me just. So basically, what I described here very roughly is what is at the basis of these conjectures of Fermat, Polyakov, and Sestine, and Sandel. So the conjecture is that some higher spin gauge theory in the boundary will be dual to some vector models in the boundary. And here I discuss the case of free vector models, but there is actually, as we see later, there is also the possibility of consider relevant deformations of this free theory, which flow to a different fixed point, which is an interacting fixed point. Then we see that those theories are also described by higher spin gauge fields. So here is maybe one motivation is that this the conjectures for vector models not only describe free theories, but also some interacting fixed point, some deformations of the free theory, which will be, as we will see later. another motivation, as we were saying a minute ago, is to understand understand ABS CFT in general in the limit in which the CFTs will be coupled, and maybe this can be used to reconstruct the Ball theory starting from the primitive CFT. So one example that we are all familiar with is the duality between anima for supremes and type 2B string theory. So here we have the two coupling and here we have the two coupling is related to the ratio of the ABS radius and alpha prime, and N is related to the ratio of ABS radius and Planck length. Okay, so usually, so we study usually this theory in the Tuft limit, in which we take n goes to infinity at lambda fixed, and then we can study sublimits of lambda. So the one which was most explored is the limit of strong coupling, which lambda is much greater than 1, and this is dual to some weakly coupled string theory, weakly coupled sigma model, where the coupling constant of the sigma model is even by alpha prime. But we can also ask what happens in the opposite limit of lambda much smaller than 1. In particular, we can consider the extreme limit of lambda going to 0. So this means that we have an extremely strongly coupled sigma model. We have a limit in which basically the string becomes tensionless. In this tensionless limit, we basically expect that all the power of massive modes in the string, which where the mass is controlled by alpha prime, basically collapses and becomes a power of massless fields. And this is expected by the same argument that I was giving here, because so even in this so in this gauge theory, in the free limit, we also have an infinite set of conserved currents, which are the analog of what I wrote for the vector model. So this is some field. Okay. So these are conserved current in the free limit, and they should be able to gauge some gauge field in ABS phi. But the different important difference to stress here compared to the vector model is that these are not the only single trace operators that we should consider. There are many more, actually exponentially many more single trace operators, which you can build by putting any number of fields, possibly the derivatives. So this stuff should be dual to some extra matter fields coupled to the gauge fields in ABS phi. So in the tensionless limit, whatever that means of this theory, but if you are able to define it properly, it should be some higher spinning gauge theory coupled to metrophysics. So it's some kind of non-minimal higher spinning gauge theory. While on the other hand, the vector models are an example in which we expect the higher spinning gauge theory to be just minimal, to just contain a spectrum of massless higher spinning gauge fields.
And would that be a useful description that you can compute it?
Well, here you're not really... Well, it depends what you mean by compute. On the gauge theory side, you don't really you know how to compute things in perturbative regime. So here is more like, on one side is a matter of principle to check whether ABS safety still works in this limit. And also, so you want to understand the details of how this tension of this limit work.
So would you also consider the analog by taking very strong coupling and start trying to study the gauge theory directly in the clinic?
Yes, but that's what we have been trying to do. What integrability does, in a sense, allows you to study the strong coupling in the gauge theory. For example. But you know, yes.
The integrability of the ideas.
It's also, I don't think it's really something that is useful on the gauge theory science, and it doesn't teach you how to compute things in a better way, but as a matter of principle, well, it could also be a way to prove ABS-CFT in this limit. Start from perturbative gauge theory, and from that, reconstruct the bug theory.
Okay, so that is the aim.
One possible aim. Yes?
Yeah. From this point of view, what do you know at this point about this just the spin 2? So I understand the argument for all the higher spins,
yeah.
Higher spin gauge fields, but you expect that one of those is the ordinary spin 2 and
right.
That it is full grad. Is it full general relativity coupled to the higher spins, mm-hmm. or is it just the higher spins on ADS background?
No. So as I said, there is always a stress tensor. So in any CFT, we have the stress tensor. So there must be a graviton in the bulk, too. Graviton plus higher spin.
Right. So it must be a theory which, in the bulk, looks like general relativity coupled to these infinite number
of higher spins. Yes, it doesn't have to be general relativity. It could be some higher derivative modification of general relativity. Actually, this is the case. I mean, this Basilev higher spin gauge theory is the gravitational. If you just look at the purely gravitational interaction, it doesn't agree with Einstein-Hilbert action. It has some corrections, some higher derivative corrections, though.
Are they known all exactly?
No, they're not.
But I mean, everything has.
You can see in perturbative. I mean, by computing these 3-point functions, you can see that.
But I mean, everything has higher derivative corrections. But the leading term is Einstein.
At quadratic level, it's equivalent to linearized Einstein. At interacting level. This, if you consider the 3-point function of the stress energy tensor, so this would be graviton,
good.
With some cubic coupling there. Sure. This cubic coupling is not the same as the one you get by expanding Einstein-Hilbert to third order. It's
even at leading order.
Yes.
Even at leading order.
Just meeting this, yes.
But you only know how to expand it around ADS, or something. You don't know how to find other saddle points.
Of this bulk theory?
Yeah.
So far, I mean, there are other solutions that have been found recently which are asymptotic with ABS, but they look more like black hole solutions in the interior. But, I don't think anybody so far studied the linearized fluctuations around those solutions.
Just to clarify, I think there might have been a miscommunication. or maybe I'm misunderstanding. If you take three gravitons or three spin two field,
yeah,
and you look at the coupling there,
yeah,
if I make a derivative expansion of that that three-point coupling, is that looks like the three-point coupling of Einstein gravity or not? The first term.
Well, there is no derivative expansion that you can do in this theory.
Okay.
Because there is no alpha prime. I mean, there. As I said here, there is only one dimensionless expansion parameter. So all higher derivatives are on the same footing. You need to include all of them.
About your previous remark. Is it clear on general grounds that the Wilson-Fisher fixed point should have infinitely many conserved currents, or does that require some work to see that?
In three dimensions.
I will discuss it a little bit later, but in that case, the higher spin points are only approximately conserved, so leaving more than one there. So it means that in the bulk, we should have this gauge field should acquire some mass by some loop effect. So some you can imagine a loop correction for this gauge field in the bulk. And in the case of the theory, which is supposed to be dual to the critical point, this should be non-trivial and break the higher spin gauge symmetry and give a mass to the but they are conserved at leaving more than one over n. So the free spectrum still in the bulk still expected to contain higher spin gauge. Any other question?
Trying to match the perturbative expansion in the gauge field and the perturbative expansion in the bulk.
Yes, you're having in mind this example. But the example I'm going to discuss later is the case of this dualities involving vector models or their critical points, in which you don't have a cup analogous to lambda Eulerian n. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're matching a 1 over n expansion in the CFT with a 1 over n expansion in the bulk. Mm-hmm. So the coupling constant there is 1 over n. So perturbative means, in this case, 1 over n expansion.
Yes.
Maybe one more question to clarify the last one. Do you understand the case where the boundary is three-dimensional and the bulk is four-dimensional?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that case, what is the coupling of the spin twos look like? Is that there would be no coupling at all in Einstein? There would be no either propagation or interaction of spin two in Einstein gravity. But you still have, when the bulk is three-dimensional, do you still have propagation and coupling of spin two?
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood. You want to consider the bulk to be three-dimensional?
Yeah.
Okay.
So in that case, can you still compute the propagator and correlation functions of spin 2?
Well, okay. I think, yeah, you should be able to do it, but I'm not sure how it works, because so far nobody has computed the correlation function in a three-dimensional case.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. In that case, it's supposed to be slightly simpler, even because you have an explicit action in three-dimension for these higher spin theories, which is similar to Chern-Simons action. Okay, but I don't know, because I'm not sure about the three-dimensional case. I've not considered that.
Okay. Yeah, another question?
Sorry, I have a quick question. In the four-dimensional case, Lee asked about the graviton-graviton interaction. Is that also true even if you truncate the bulk theory to the spin 2 case?
Yes, well, first of all, it's not clear if you can truncate bulk theory to the spin 2 case. But if you can do that, then you should read out what is the qubit coupling, for example, of the graviton. And what I'm saying is that it's not going to agree with Einstein Hilbert hash. It's going to contain a power of higher degree of fractions.
Okay.
In this theory, as we will see, it's quite difficult to read off what is exactly the coupling in terms of the physical fields. But there is some procedure in which you can compute these holographic three-point functions, and you get some result. And you can compare with computations which have been done in Einstein-Hilbert gravity, and they do not agree.
Okay, and
so
that
tells you that the qubit coupling must be different.
That's even true at the tree level, or
yeah, at this level, at this level. Yeah. Okay. Here I'm anticipating a bit something which I was going to discuss later. But in three dimensions, in general, if you compute the stress energy tensor three-point function, conformal symmetry and the conservation of the stress energy tensor constraint, this will be a linear combination of two possible structures, two independent structures. We call it AB schematically like this. Plus AF. So these two structures are what you get by computing TTT in a free boson theory, like the one I wrote here. You compute the TTT stress energy tensor three-point function in this theory, you get a structure which I call B. You can do the same in a theory in which you have a free Fermi instead. If you compute the stress energy tensor in this free theory, the tensor structure is a different one, and it's independent from this one. In general, for a general theory, you have a linear combination of these two, just by using conformal symmetry and conservation of T. So people have computed this TTT from Einstein gravity several years ago, I think Frolov and Arutyunov. In that case, you find that the answer from Einstein-Hilbert is AB equal to AF. So you get precisely the sum of these two structures in this case. While in this Vasilev theories, as we will see later, there are two different theories. One of them is supposed to be dual to free scalars, and the other one is supposed to be dual to free fermions. And in one theory, you get precisely AF equal to zero, and in the other theory, you get AB equal to zero. So it means that this cannot agree with these calculations in Einstein-Hilbert. In general, if you try to deform Einstein-Hilbert by adding some higher derivative term, like the one you like, by the cube, for example, you will find that these relative coefficients are modified. So this Vasilev theories should contain the right, precisely the right higher derivative modification of Einstein-Hilbert, such that these coefficients are modified in the way which I just described. Either one or the other is zero.
It's super symmetry.
What, sorry?
It's evidence that Einstein gravity has to do with super symmetry.
Yes, you can.
So it means that super symmetric theories have to do with Einstein gravity. It's mm-hmm. Let me know you.
Okay.
Okay. What would the coefficient of my Lyle cube term be, though? I mean, you stressed to me that there's no expansion parameter. So if I had Einstein and I wanted to add to that Lyle cube, what would the coefficient be? What's the dimension for?
Well, I mean, that would be just the power of the cosmological constants.
Oh,
that
bar,
the same,
yeah.
Same okay. Dimension.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, so let me now switch a little bit topic. So go to the descriptions of higher spin gauge theories, and for the moment forget about log. The theories for higher spins is a subject which has a very long history, and there is a lot of literature, and I'm definitely not an expert on it. So if you have something that you want to add, feel free to add. I'm just giving a partial list of relevant facts which would be useful for the purpose of these lectures. Okay, I'm just starting with a little bit of history. If for massive higher spin theories have been discussed, well, the three equations for massive higher spin fields have been written down very long ago by Fields and Pauli in 1939. So in this case, the let's say flat space equations of motion for a free massive higher spin field take the following form. So phi is a symmetric and traceless tensor, which is transverse. Okay, so this is the case of massive higher spin fields, and if one counts the independent components of such a field, one finds that these equations propagate 2s plus 1 in degrees of freedom, as we expect for a massive spin field. The massless limit was considered quite many years later by Fronsdahl. His description is still based on a symmetric S-component tensor field, which is constrained to be double traceless. Field, we must have a gauge invariance to decouple the unphysical degrees of freedom. And the gauge invariance, which generalizes the one for lower spins, is just what you would expect. So this generalizes the case of spin 1, in which you have a scalar parameter epsilon, and spin 2. So this is the generalization proposed by Fronsdahl for higher spins. So you have a totally symmetric spin S minus 1 parameter, and this is the gauge transformation. And the equation of motion which describes this free higher spin gauge field in flat space take the following form and call this object. Okay, so this is the equation, and if you look at the variation of this equation with respect to this gauge symmetry, you find that this goes like this. So you see that the Cartesian variance must impose that the gauge parameter is basis. Which, so you don't have such a condition for the lower spin cases to not take any trace there. But here you see that this, in order for gauge invariance to work, you need this to be basis. Okay, and you can check that this equation reduced to the Maxwell equation for spin 1, and it reduces to the linearized Einstein equation for spin 2.
Couldn't you instead just ask the... Oh! Build the epsilon thing to match?
Yeah.
Instead of depending on the gauge parameter of the traceless, you can't just man it like... mu, epsilon, mu.
I think there would be a much more. Well, you want epsilon to be some arbitrary function of space time. That would come.
It would be a different kind of constraint.
I think that would be a much stronger constraint.
Why don't you just amend the, you know, if you take these three derivatives, you get zero.
Yeah,
but
it must be true for any three indices, right? Mm-hmm. They are not contracted.
They are not.
Oh, I see. So maybe the only solution is that epsilon.
So there is no way to fill out the
constant.
The BD is operating.
Okay, good. Yeah. This is a failure of my addition.
Can you argue why?
Okay. Yeah.
Continue.
Okay, so Franzbell also wrote down an action from which this equation can be derived. Right here, the action for completeness, although one thing we need it much later. Double traceless condition, which is non-trivial starting from spin equal to 4, comes from requiring that this action is gauge invariant. You wouldn't see it from the equations, I think, but looking at the gauge variation of this action, you would find that you need to impose this constraint on this double traceless condition. I don't think I want to go through the calculation, but It's a well-known fact. Any question? Okay. So we have this equation for massless gauge fields. I didn't really say it, but from now on, I'm always in four dimensions. So this is really for the four-dimensional case.
Let me ask Kenny. Can you add to this action another term proportional to this S minus 2, S minus 1, S? It would make the equation of motion gauge invariant for any epsilon.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that question, but I suppose the answer is no. I mean, this is an empty study to that, basically, so I think. But I didn't, maybe, I didn't think about that question. You want to add something whose variation would just cancel something like this, and you don't need to impose the baselessness condition.
And it would vanish both spin 2, spin 1, as an example.
Maybe. I suspect the answer is no. Okay. So then by studying the gauge fixing of this action, by choosing either a Lorentz type gauge or a Lycom gauge, we find that this, as expected for a field in four dimensions, this propagates 2 degrees of freedom, which are just the plus minus S36. So these are the consistent free equations for a massless gauge field in four dimensions in flat space. So now that we have free theory, the question is how do we modify this free theory to include interactions in such a way that the gauge invariance is preserved? And this turned out to be an extremely difficult problem in flat space because there are in fact several powerful noble theorems which tells you that there is quite few that you can do. Most of the interactions involving higher spin gauge particles are just constrained to vanish. Let me just review briefly one of the arguments. So this is the argument of Weinberg. In 64. And there is also more recent work like Freddy and Harold and Kazi using some kind of S matrix argument to constrain the interaction involving massless particles. And maybe it is the old argument. So Feynman considers the process which has
Yeah, I missed the words that you said before writing Weinberg. What are we discussing
about? Interactions. We're discussing that it's very difficult to write down interacting higher spin gauge theories in flat space. So difficult, probably impossible. We just discussed some arguments. Okay, so Weinberg considers processing which you have n particles scattering. These particles could be, let's imagine that they are massive particles, for example, scalars, but they could also be higher spin massive particles. And then consider the process in which there is an emission of some massless spin S particle here. Okay, so what Weinberg argues is that if you consider the soft limit in which Q goes to zero, this S matrix for this process, maybe I just call it A. In the soft Q, in the Q goes to zero limit, this, let me put here a coupling constant. So let's assume that this spin S particle couples to the N particle with a coupling Gn, and so this particle could couple to any of these particles with a coupling Gi. And so in this soft limit, this S matrix is supposed to factorize like this. Here, epsilon mu 1 mu s is a polarization tensor of this spin S field, and this denominator p dot q comes from basically this propagator here, which is 1 over p plus q square. In the q goes to 0 limit, we can approximate it like that. And so this is the coupling constant.
I think.
Yeah.
I think they're really considering the full S matrix of all the particles, including the spin, that higher spin guy. And then you're taking the soft limit, and this is only the leading contribution.
Right.
Which is only when the spin S particle is attached to one of the external particles. I mean, that guy could also be attached internally.
Internally, right.
But that will not be that will not blow up in the soft limit. So you're only writing the leading contribution to the full S matrix. Yes.
And this particle could be attached to any of those particles, so that's why here I have a sum from 1 to n. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, could you say what information went into writing that? How do we know that?
Sorry?
Yeah. What assumptions led to this formula? And I can see that you get it in the field.
What do you mean by this?
Just put it in.
I suppose locality is also basically assumed here. Do you have a comment about it? Mm.
No, I think this is just concurrent invariance.
That's it.
Okay. Yeah, only this physical force is the same locality.
Well, I think in terms of the leading contribution to the soft limit.
Okay, so anyway, now the one more argument is that since this is massless in S particle, you have to decouple the physical degrees of freedom, which means that you consider this polarization tensor to be proportional to the momentum. Then this amplitude has to vanish, because this is some non-physical polarization. And then if you just plug in this form for the polarization tensor by requiring that this thing vanish, so you get a P dot Q which cancels this denominator, and then you are left with the constraint that this particular combination has to vanish.
Further, were these other external particles, were they massless as well? Is that how you got the denominator?
The P squared cancel. Had to be massless.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, so now we can look at special cases. Let's say when the spin is 1, the spin of this particle, this soft particle is 1, then that constraint just tells that the sum of these coupling constants has to be equal to 0. And this is just charge conservation. For S equal to 2. So we have this. For this to be 0 for general choice of momenta, which means that we allow a general for non-trivial scattering, then the only solution is that these GIs are all proportional to the same constant G, and the sum of the momenta is U. So this is just conservation of momentum, and this just says that all particles coupled to the spin tool with the same strength, which is just the equivalence principle derived from this argument. And for S greater than 2, one finds that those constraints are too strong, and for general momenta, there is no way to solve them unless these GIs are all zero, which means that the higher spin massless particle does not couple to those other n particles. So this was one old argument to which shows that it's very difficult to write theories with interacting higher spin massless particles in flat space. Another theorem that is often cited in this context is the Feldman-Amanduri theorem, which says that the symmetries of the S matrix cannot be larger than a direct product of Poincaré times some internal symmetry group, otherwise the S matrix would be trivial. If we have higher spin massless particle, then from those higher spin conserved currents, we have some conserved spin S minus 1 charges. Basically, it's analogous to what we get here, pretty much. And these charges would not commute with the Poincaré group. So by Coleman-Mandula, this again is another argument which says that we expect trivial S matrix if we have a higher spin gauge fields in flat space. Okay. Actually, so the difficulty with coupling higher spin gauge field to the graviton has been also investigated in the Lagrangian approach by Aragon and Deser. So what they find is looking at the Transdel action, just so to couple to graviton by equivalence principle, what we are supposed to do is just to covariantize the derivatives. That should tell us how the higher spin field should couple to the graviton if it has to obey the equivalence principle. But if one does this, one finds that the action is not KGY. One does that simple thing, then the Transdel action contains a term which goes like the Riemann tensor contracted in some way with the gauge variation and schematic, which is non-zero. There is no way to put it to zero in general. So this shows that one thing that it shows is that in flat space, around flat space, there is no coupling of the high spin gauge field and the graviton fluctuation, which preserves the equivalence principles. You cannot try that. And it also shows that it's not possible to generalize Transdel theory in arbitrary background. We have no higher spin gauge symmetries. In arbitrary background. Not even at the linearized level. Even if you just look at quadratic Transdel action in some non-flat background, we'll find that the variation is non-zero. So you cannot allow for that if you want to preserve the invariance. Question?
What do you get, think of that as a condition on the background?
But you get that the only solution is that the background is maximally symmetric space.
That's as much.
So the flat KGS. Yeah. guess just as we just said, following your question, this point two actually can be cured in the case of maximally symmetric spaces like ABS. In that case, you can co-ionize from the direction and the state invariant. So what you do is just take the from the direction and replace derivative by covariant derivatives. And then there is also some sort of mass term. Which comes out of the covariantization. It's not really a master, it's still massless. But so it's some kind of curvature coupling that you get. And the theory then is in ADS is invariant if you just take the variation with covariant.
There's a similar thing.
Sorry?
There's a similar thing for the sphere?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is the same. You just change the sign of the cosmological constant. No difference. You just change the sign here. Okay. So it was shown first by Tarkin and Vasilev. Okay. That in ADS you can go further. Yeah.
Here you are not just replacing the derivative by covariant fit. You also add extra stuff to make it gain invariant.
Yes,
but above you say that it's not possible to add extra stuff to cure that.
Yeah, it's not possible for the generic background. You can only do it for this maximum symmetric backgrounds in which the Riemann tensor is a very special form. Just that.
What if you start with that and then take up to infinity?
You get from the lecture in both space. This just goes away. And this you just delete the connection. You're back to the plus space.
And we are only the classical level.
Yeah, it is just the quadratic level. In here you can take the limit of plus space and you get your consistent quadratic reaction of plus space. Yeah. Okay, what I was going to say now is that Tarkin and Vasilev realized that in this ABS background, or the S background, you can actually go beyond this quadratic level and define three-point couplings, which are consistent with gauge invariants. Not going to write in the form of this coupling, just schematically. The feature of these couplings is that they are always higher derivative couplings. Which you can do in ABS because you have the powers of cosmological constants.
I think before is that we don't already before we're having interactions, we don't consider loops.
Sorry.
Before we're having interactions, when we come to the reality. Only interested in the classical level, we don't consider loops.
You're just interested in writing down an action, yes, which is consistent with the HC. So it's a classical action.
You're only studying classical loops.
Well, before going to doing loops, you need to write down a consistent action. Once you have it, you can start doing loops. But
No,
I mean when you insert interactions.
Here,
at this level, the graviton is not blocked yet. Okay. This is just some fixed background. complete interactions. That's what Fabian and Vasilyev did. They wrote down consistent interaction of the higher spins between, well, higher spins between themselves, in particular the ground. This can be different higher spins. Okay. So a feature here, these interactions, is since they involve higher derivatives, you need a cosmological constant to get something dimensionless, and you can see here that the limit, the plus case limit, is not is a singular limit. So there is no way to, at least not a very straightforward way to get to go to the plus case here, which agrees with all those Noble theorems, which tell you that it's very difficult to write down interactions in flat space. Okay, and after this work of Fabian and Vasilyev in a series of many works, well, roughly 80s and 90s, he was able to write down a set of consistent equations of motion which describe, so we have consistent equations of motion for all spins in ADS. Well, ADS 4, there is also generalization to ADS general dimension, if you wrote that. But for these lectures, we'll just describe the ADS 4 case. So these are fully nonlinear equations. So they involve couplings of the higher spin field to all orders, in cubic and so on. And they are gauging by. So, by definition, this is a solution to the ADS, to the problem of finding interacting pure higher spin fields, gauge fields. Okay. So, one aim of these lectures will be to try to describe these equations a little bit. So I have to say that here the formalism is very much probably unfamiliar to most people, so we have to spend some time to do the details with the patients.
There are multiple solutions.
Yes. You mean there is not only one theory? Yes. Okay. So the structure of these equations is almost unique. There is a choice of one function. Okay. There is one function of one of the fields in the theory which you can choose. If you impose a parity symmetry, then you end up with only two possible fields, which are dual to the free scalars of preference that I described before. In general, for non-parity invariant theories, you have more freedom. We'll go into that later, not today.
Are there fermionic generalizations?
Yes. Yeah, so what I've been discussing so far was just the pure the bosonic case, but yes, there are fermionic. So there is a purely bosonic theory, and there is also supersymmetric extensions in this theory, which include higher spin of half integers of all spins. Again, I will concentrate on the bosonic space. But there are such generalizations.
Do you know a reference and a name of somebody? That's not the supersymmetric one.
Oh, it's. Yeah. Yeah, I am. Yes, here or not. Okay.
these equations in principle a big solution where the gravity is set to zero and the background is ISP?
Sorry,
can this equation in principle admit solution when gravity is set to zero and the background is ISP?
Gravity set to zero, you mean flat space? Or you mean no space?
No. Yeah. Why not?
You can. There is always the Taylor solution, just all the fields set to zero. That's a non-generic solution.
Yeah. And that's the ABS false solution?
I think you're asking, is there a solution where the fields of ADS are set to zero, where the frame field and the connection of the ADS space-time are zero, but there's still consistent dynamics of the higher spin fields?
Not dynamics, just the background.
You mean that the background is ADS and there is no metric equation? No, or you mean the background is
this solution admits, this equation admits a solution when all the ISP is set to zero and the background is ADS?
Yes. Definitely, yes.
Can it admit other solution where there is no two-spin field at all, there is no metric, but there are IO spin, I don't know.
Principle, it should.
Why not?
Because the formalism, as you will see, doesn't include a choice of the metric. So, in principle, it admits degenerate solutions, which is for the Frank Field to be zero. But there is a choice of the frame fields and the connection, but there is no constraint that they would be non-degenerate, as far as I know.
yes, but although I'm not sure if you can write down a solution in which the higher spin fields are non-zero and the metric is zero, then I'm not sure if you can do. Moreover, I mean, I don't know what's the interpretation of such a solution. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, I missed the point probably, but we are always expanding around ADS, so.
No. You don't start with saying ADS plus blah blah blah. It's just a blah, blah, blah.
I didn't write the equations yet, but in form they can be written in a form which is the ground independent. Just in terms of some of the puppets.
Admit ADS is one of the
solutions. ADS is a solution. Flat space is not a solution. In order to write down these equations, so far I've been talking about this Fronsdal formulation in which higher spin field is some symmetric S tensor, but these equations are, well, Basilev's observation is that these equations are better described using the analog of the frame formulation of gravity. Gravity, which instead of working with the metric, we work with the midline, and then we have a spin connection. So these are the flat kind of stress indices. This is anti-symmetric in AMD. And so there is the gauge symmetry. Part which is the same as the diffeomorphism invariance, and then there is a local Lorentz transformation with some anti-symmetric parameter, and this is the gauge field for that local Lorentz transformation. And
when you wrote this L interaction here, you were, it was an expansion around ADS. Then in the second half of the blackboard, it's some, you generalize to L.
Right. So the first part, of course, makes sense when you say it's an expansion around the ADS.
Yeah. Well, even here, I don't know if there's anything which makes sense, which is not an expansion around the ADS. I mean, the equations can be written down in some form which does not require you to think of a background. But once you want to study some dynamics, you have to start with some solution and consider fluctuations of the solution. And that solution, I think, has to be asymptotic to ADS. I don't think there are any solutions which are something which do not look like ADS.
So the thing is that the cosmological constant cannot be set to zero, and I think that the original theory does not contain a scalar field to compensate for that, so you cannot possibly have flat space. And even if you add a scalar field, I think it is in such a way that you can never cancel the contribution from the cosmological constant. But it's ADS in the sense that the cosmological constant can never be set to zero because the interactions are non-analytic in the cosmological constant.
Does it
not
well, that's
something
that you see from here. You have to start expanding around the ADS to see that. From the equations themselves,
is consider a solution of this point?
Yes.
Just an exaggeration.
Yes.
Always been talking about Kaskal coaching.
Yeah, I think there is analogous topic for me, yes. Okay, so. So here. Okay, so in this Cartan formulation of gravity, there is this extra spin connection which gets related to the V-line by the condition of torsion being zero. Right. And then using this local Lorentz invariance, you can gauge away the antisymmetric part of the V-line, and in the end, the metric gets identified with the symmetric part of the V-line. So this is roughly how you go back to a metric-like formulation. Okay, so this is the torsion that you have curvature. Just the standard familiar curvature to write down for connection. And okay. And in this language, the gravity finds a new attraction can be written like this. It's natural to combine the Gilbert and spin connection into a single SO3,2 connection. W. Where PA and MAD are the generators of the SO3,2 algebra, so this the translation and these are the Lorentz generators. And so the curvature of this combined connection is the torsion plus
doesn't that require a cosmological constant in W?
Yeah, I didn't write what is yet.
No, but I mean, if you want to combine the frame fields and the connect and the Lorentz connection, you need a cosmological constant to form the ADS algebra.
Right. I mean, these are generators of the ADS algebra. So in particular, P does not commute with P, but goes like 1 over PP is 1 over, well,
oh, okay.
The cosmological constant.
So you've already scaled the, so P and N have different dimensions. So that's where you put the constant.
Yes. So that curvature RAB is the Lorentz part, which is what I wrote there, plus there is the cosmological
Are you talking about any visitor space, or are
you talking about
writing some general
visitor space?
Because
the pieces of the background. So far, okay, as you described.
Up to here,
it's general. Yeah. Here, yes.
This formulation of general relativity is completely general. You can write an action in terms of the W, which is completely, which is equivalent to the Einstein action with the cosmological constant.
That's
the notion
of the cosmological constant.
You're right. It's just, yes, but there has to be a cosmological constant.
Yeah.
So the cosmological constant is a parameter in the action.
Yeah. This is just some review to motivate the later construction of Vasilyev, in which these curvatures will be generalized to higher spin curvature, including higher spin fields. So far, this is just standard gravity rewritten in terms of these curvatures. And just as a parenthetical remark, In this formulation, an action was proposed by McDowell and Mansouri. In which the standard Einstein action can be written in a form which is more similar to Young-Liss action, adapting in the curvatures. So they showed that using that curvature, you can write the action in this way. This R, which combines the standard curvature and the wavelength part. And you see that here you have a cosmological constant in front of 1 over lambda. If you expand this curvatures in terms of depth expansion, you will find 3 terms. So one term will come from a cross term, will be 1 over 2 k squared R and B, which E C will be B. A, B, C, D, where lambda is cancelled with the rest of that, and this is just an Einstein-Hilbert part without cosmological constant. Then there is a term which is the cosmological constant term coming from the square of that term. So this is lambda probably 4. This is just square root of g lambda, so it's the cosmological term in the action. So, okay, there's another term, third term. Which is the, this is Lorentz curvature, just built out of the omegas. And then there is another term, which is, you recognize it to be the Euler density of your space. So this does not modify the equations of motion. So what McDowell and Mansour showed is that this action, at least the level of classical equations of motion, is equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action with the cosmological constant. And the only reason that this is just because it turns out that it is this form of the action that guided Fragin and Basile to write down the qubit interaction in ABS. Basically, they wrote down a generalization of these curvatures in terms of higher spin, Gilbert, and higher spin connections. And an action of this form produces consistent qubit couplings. How much time? Just a comment here. So in the case of gravity, this is just a topological term, but it's important to see that it's a higher derivative. It contains higher derivative terms. And the analogous term for higher spin fields will not be topological and will have some non-trivial interactions here. Okay, that's the final comment. And, tomorrow we're going to continue and finally write down these Basilev equations. And, yeah.